Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Imagine the feeling of pulsing electric shocks. Sounds like a nightmare, right? While individual experiences may vary, it's how some people describe shingles. This painful blistering rash could interrupt your life for weeks. It could even force you to cancel social events or weekend plans. Over 99% of adults 50 years or older already carry the virus that causes shingles. 1 in 3 people will get it in their lifetime. Why wait? Ask your doctor or pharmacist about shingles today.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to Soft Web Radio. Soft Web Radio, on time, on target. We have a great podcast lined up this afternoon. We want to welcome our special guest with us, Jack Devine. Jack is an author. He's written a couple of really good books. In fact, we had him on our podcast about 6-7 years ago when he wrote the book Good Hunting, An American Spymaster Story. It was a New York Times bestseller. But now Jack has written another one called The Spymaster's Prison, The Fight Against Russian Aggression. It's due out on March 1st. We were thankful to get an advanced copy of it. It is a very compelling read, and we encourage all of our readers and listeners out there to definitely check this book out. Just to give you a little background on Jack, as I said to him when we first started talking, Mr. Devine, but he said to call him Jack. So Jack was a 32-year veteran of the CIA. He served, obviously, he was a Cold War guy. He started back in the late 60s. He went up through, I think, 1999. You know, he was in charge of the CIA's counter-narcotics center. He also was in charge of the Afghan task force when the Russians were involved in Afghanistan. We were funding the Mujahideen, and we're going to definitely talk about that because we have some, I guess, the sixth degree of separation. But anyway, he's been there. He's been involved in everything. He worked his way up to the acting director of operations for the CIA. So Jack has started from the ground level and worked his way all the way up to that top floor. So we want to welcome him to the podcast. Jack, thanks for taking the time with us this afternoon. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's a great privilege. Your audience means a great deal to me. You have people defending this country and have defended it in the past. And for me to spend time with him is a great privilege.
Well, I love the way your book started off because you had a quote from an Afghan, I guess considered the modern founder of the Afghan nation. And this quote is, "My last words to you, my son and successor, never trust the Russians." And, you know, for somebody who grew up in the Cold War like myself and served them during that time frame, I couldn't feel any different.
I have a plaque in my office that has that quote on, and I wasn't familiar with it. But Charlie Wilson, who I'm sure virtually everybody or audience knows, Congressman Wilson and his role in the Afghan program, gave me that plaque, and it stuck with me. I didn't think it was going to land. In other words, when the Cold War came to an end, I thought, well, maybe I'll take it down. I'm glad I kept it up.
Yeah, so, there you go.
I'm almost entitled the book that "Never Trust the Russians." And maybe in retrospect, maybe I should have put that in as the second line. I know we toyed with it, the publisher.
I'll tell you what, that was the best way to start it off. And, you know, I think part of the gist of the book is the Cold War really isn't over, is it? Because, you know, some of the maybe main people have changed, but the goal is still the same, isn't it?
What's interesting about that, Steve, is around the first chapter of the book, I talk about Comrade Jay. Comrade Jay was the deputy chief of what we used to call the KGB, and now it's called the SVR, New York City. And he was a walk-in. He came to the agency and volunteered his services. And you can imagine in that position, he was extremely knowledgeable. You know, for the KGB in New York, it's a very active, high activity operation. So in there, he said, you know, when I joined the KGB, we had three main targets: the United States, NATO, and China. And when I left in 2004, he defected, and we took care of him. But in 2004, he said, when I left, the three objectives were the United States, NATO, and China. So it never stopped. Now, there was a period, I mean, I happened to be in Russia, and I go into this in June of 91, and the government fell in August. I actually had an appointment to see the deputy chief of the KGB. I was their guest, believe it or not, even after my significant role in the Afghan program. I was their guest because we wanted to warm up relations with the Russians, and anything they could think about talking about was counter-narcotics. So I was head of counter-narcotics, so I went out there, and we made a visit with the KGB. They were the host, actually. It's very ironic. But at the last minute, I was canceled from seeing the head of the KGB, and I saw the deputy. It was quite normal, and we went on with the trip. Part of the deal, because I had no great interest in going to Moscow at that time, but the fellow that was head of Russian operations, Milt Bearden, who's a public figure, he was our chief out in Islamabad in those days. He said, if you come out, we'll have them fly us down to look at the poppy fields. But the poppy fields are right beside the Friendship Bridge, and I have a deal with them. If you come, you and I will stand on the bridge with the KGB, the Friendship Bridge, where the Russians slept. So I said, I'll in. So I went, and we have this great, great picture. But what was interesting is in August, the government was overthrown. The communist government collapsed in August of 91. I was there 2 months before. It's coincidental that I was there 2 months before, I quickly point out. But what was interesting at that moment is, what was the future? What was it going to be? and so many people, well, the Cold War's over, we won peace dividend, we don't need to worry about the Russians. And we, over the years, cut our budget back, GDP, from a slice of, rather the intelligence budget, from 70% focused on Russia to 10%. So the point was, there was a period in time where, going right to your question, Steve, where everyone was convinced the Cold War was over. And there might have been a few months, but it was shortly, the KGB was one of the last places to give up its stronghold on its files and so on. So they did continue to run operations, and I hope we talk about it later, the famous mole inside of the FBI, Robert Hansen, actually received a message right at the end after they collapsed and said, look, don't worry, we're going to take care of you, we're not stopping. So the point is, they recovered and they got stronger. Putin came, and he is a KGB guy. And let me stop there, because we can talk about him and other questions. But the struggle with the Russians never ended. And I think we'll talk more about it, but I want to give it back to you rather than me going on with the history of the book.
Yeah. Well, and again, in the book, you basically, you know, you make the point that Russia is still our probably biggest enemy, you know, on the world stage. And, you know, I thought that was a little surprising. Because everyone today talks about the Chinese and their economic power and the fact that, you know, the Chinese are trying to, you know, build up that, whatever they call it, the Belt and Road Initiative and their economy. And they're kind of dusting off our game plan of how we brought down the Soviet Union against us. And I was a little surprised by that. But you were saying that you believe that the Russians are still our biggest threat in the world. And can you talk about that a little bit?
That's a great question. Actually, I'm surprised it's our second question. You know, usually someone doesn't raise it till much later. In fact, when I was writing the book, I don't want to talk and bore your audience about the struggles of writing a book. This isn't what I do. I have a full-time job running my own company with a partner of mine, Stanley Arkin. So this is something I believe in, the subject matter, and I like, it's a way of getting your voice out. In fact, there's an old saying, you know, old soldiers never die, they fade away. You know, MacArthur said that in the Congress. And I would say old spies never fade away, unless they have a pen. If they have a pen, they can keep on writing. So, you know, I wrote the book, and in the process, I eventually came to the Russian issue because of the 2016 involvement. So I don't really dwell very long in the book on China, because you can get spun away into what's going on with China and then still terrorism, and it becomes a hodgepodge. But I have thought about it a great deal since then, and it's part of my, you know, thought process that any podcast, if someone doesn't ask, I'm going to go to the issue that you just did, Steve, and thank you for that. Because China is our number one, you know, what I call existential threat, if you want to say that, in terms of economic, military power. They're on the run. They're building. They're strong. Their economy. They are clearly the country that we need from a national security point of view to keep an eye on. But when we look at Russia, it's half of what it was during the Cold War, because they lost. They lost Ukraine, they lost all the countries around them. But when you look at their intelligence operations, and this is why I would refine, if I were rewriting a paragraph in a book, I would refine it this way. They're the real intelligence threat. Now, the Chinese came late to human intelligence. You know, if you look back, there were very few real significant spy cases involving the Chinese until fairly recently, the last 20 years. And they're contained a bit because of the nature of the economic relationship with the United States. So they're certainly in the United States collecting information. They do it in bulk, they do it in cyber. But when you say to yourself, who runs really hard-edged intelligence operations in the United States? Who have spies? Who have years of work on getting penetrations inside the government? And even when you start to look at how aggressive are the Chinese in meddling in internal affairs in the United States, then you would say the Russians have been far more threatening if you look at what they did in the 2016 election. And if you look at the recent hack where they hacked into the State Department, DHS, Energy, Treasury, and I think the world is only looking at the tip of the iceberg. So I would refine it if I were putting another paragraph in the book, and that would be, you know, we need to man up, if you will, for dealing with China as a major threat. Both of them have nuclear weapons, and it's mutual destruction, so that's sort of a counterweight. In all the ways one acts around the world, you know, China is going to be the biggest handful. But if you look at Russia, and you look at what they're in the United States, but if you look at Putin's game plan, it is a Cold War, right on. It's a Cold War game plan. And, you know, communism doesn't exist. He's not propagating it, but he is propagating the old Russia objectives. Warm water ports, weaken your adversaries, weaken the countries around you. And to use very aggressive force. He's used it in the Crimea and Ukraine. So he is very formidable, and his tactically, we could talk about the strategy in a minute. So it's in that context, and I know I've gone on a bit, but, you know, there's almost a knee-jerk reaction. People say, well, it's got to be China. And that's true in the macro picture. But if you talk about intelligence threats, national security, and intelligence operations, the Russians, I still put it number one.
And, you know, talking about the Russians, and you mentioned the, you know, the excuse me, the interference in the 2016 election, and then you just mentioned the hacking. You know, you talk at length in the book about the Moscow rules, how they were breaking the Moscow rules, and how they, you know, everyone since the beginning of time, I guess, we've always collected intelligence on each other, but we don't act upon it. That's what basically the Moscow rules are, correct?
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I meant to say, but they've taken that one step further, and they've acted upon that, and that's something that we've never done against each other up until this time.
So that's a great observation, and I want to give you a pat on the back. You know, I've been interviewed by a lot of people over the years, and sometimes they read a chapter or a snippet that someone gives them. You clearly have read my book, so I'm quite flattered, and I want to compliment you because it's a key point. It's a really important thing to understand, and that is in the Cold War, which you and I were involved in, and you know, I was involved, and so were you beyond that. But in the Cold War, there were some unwritten rules. And the unwritten rules were you didn't counterfeit each other's money. Why? Because you would destroy the entire economic system, right? Except for a couple isolated incidents. We did not rough up each other's officers. Now, there were some big incidents, you can imagine, but not many. So there were certain ground rules. We were not going to be involved in targeted assassinations and all those things against each other. So there were ground rules, and one of them was, and again, you're not going to find this written down in a single contract, but we were not going to interfere directly in the political dynamics of internal countries. We weren't going to stir up a revolution in Russia, and we expected them not to fiddle around in our elections. That was an understanding of the Moscow rules. Now, there was another phrase, another more modern, I'm dating it from, say, the beginning of the Cold War. Later on, there were other intelligence people that referred to Moscow rules and how you behave in Moscow. In other words, you don't wear a Mets hat if you're going out for a clandestine meeting and so on. And there are legitimate things on how you operate, and it's very tactical. But there is one that supersedes that, and that is this understanding you don't meddle in each other's internal affairs. So the big deal for me in 2016, I actually had trouble comprehending it, saying, it can't be. They cannot just be hacking. I mean, they're hacking, but they're using it. They're going in and trolling In the Facebook, I mean, there's, as you know, in the book, I mean, thousands and thousands of things of messages that were in their hands. And while it may have marginally, and I believe this to be the case, I was surprised by the fact that the Russians were meddling directly in our internal political affairs. We are not doing it in their country, and we haven't been. So it's a major, it's a seismic change in how you do business. And there are no, in the present day, there are no Moscow rules. Apparently they've been abrogated, and the Russians are much more aggressive, and particularly it involves the United States internal affairs. And this needs to be corrected. So the problem in cyber warfare, which so many of the people out there are experts, everyone, as you said early on, is collecting everything they can, from the smallest country, largest country. There's so much technical capability, everybody tries to collect. But it's the use of the information and how you use these cyber tools that are quite different. And there is a bit of instability right now in the cyber world because there are no rules. There are rules in the nuclear exchange, there's treaties, there's negotiations that have been worked out over many years, but cyber. And the Russians are now, when you look at it, extremely aggressive in this space. And it was a dilemma for the Trump administration near the end. And it's a dilemma of the Biden administration. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah. And before we get into that, I just wanted to share, I mean, as again, going back to being a Cold Warrior, we used to study our potential adversary. And When the story first came out that the Russians were, you know, meddling in the election basically for the benefit of President Trump over Hillary Clinton, I discounted that. I was like, and I'll be honest with you, I said that can't be true, because the Russians, from reading about them, studying what I could, they value stable, predictable personalities. And as we all know, President Trump is none of those things. He's kind of like that I don't want to say oddball, but he's that wild card that's in the mix. And I found it very interesting that the Russians would favor him over Clinton, who they knew, obviously, much better than they did Trump.
I had the same reaction. But in the process of writing the book, and as I dug through some research, I kept trying to figure this out, because, as you said, what you really want on the other side is someone that's very predictable. You want civility. They know the Trump, they knew the Biden people. They know the Hillary people. They knew the Bush people. They knew what they were getting. You can work within parameters. They weren't sure. So I would say, well, it's really, it just makes no sense. Or have they lost their marbles in this? But the more I get into it, and I know you and your team are aware of this, but, you know, they've developed a strategy we call hybrid warfare, right? Mm-hmm. And the warfare is, while they might use, it's very hard now to put land armies against each other among major powers, right? So there is a struggle, and the hybrid warfare strategy suggested you use propaganda, economic, you use cyber, and you try and weaken the enemy. You just weaken the enemy, right? So I actually believe that it wasn't as sharply focused as we think. It wasn't that they wanted Trump to win so much as they thought that that was the best way to weaken the environment. In other words, you would have the political chaos, and they don't want a coup. They don't want an overthrow of government, but their strategy is to weaken America's political fiber. And I think to some degree that was successful. The operation wasn't so successful in the sense of, okay, how many ballot boxes did they impact? I'd say very little, but their involvement then led to the Mueller investigation and party and the very partisan environment got worse. So, I mean, to some degree, I'm not sure they had this great vision of how far it was going to go. But their motivations are not so person-directed. And I know there's a whole school book out that Trump's a spy, and that's all nonsense in my view. But their objective was a different one, and they want to keep us off balance, and they want to undermine us, and that's why they're in the cyberspace. They're spreading, malicious rumors and disinformation, and they've been in the disinformation pre-Bolshevik period, right? The Russians have been in the disinformation, and they're very good at it. I go into a couple of examples. One of the things I do in the book is go back and forth of lessons learned from what they did in the past. And if I could ramble for just one case that I go into, there was a great case by a Russian defector was involved when it came out. And back in the middle of the Cold War, suddenly there was a trove of documents, Nazi documents that were found, right? Deep Sea Diver, Operation Neptune. Mm-hmm. They bring up, but it was all Russian disinformation. And Mark, or this fellow that defected to us, said, look, we fabricated all of this, but it did great damage in the German government because it tied many people to the Nazi government. They weren't. And so they've been around, and it's a classic case of sort of how do you stir up trouble out there. So I think we should move away when we're looking at them. It's so much about Trump. I think Trump did some, as you know, in terms of the Ukraine, was pretty aggressive and pushing back and sanctions and so on. So I think there's a bigger part of their strategy, and it's not to defeat us, overthrow us, but to keep us weak. And the weaker we are, the more freedom they have, and the less able we are to check them anywhere. So it took me a long time to come to what I believe is my sense of where they are.
Yeah, and you mentioned that in the book, and it was fascinating about that Internet Research Agency. You know, it's run by the same guy who runs the Wagner Group, who all of our readers know all about that because that's the Putin chef. And you talked about the 80,000 Facebook, personas and, 2,700 Twitter accounts and thousands of YouTube videos, all spreading this disinformation or misinformation program, whatever you want to call it. And the Not My President movement was all of Russian fabrication. And I think it was very successful at subverting us and driving us further apart than we already were.
Right. I think that would be a point that I underscore as well. It's not so much about who won the election. It's just the chaos or political turmoil that folded from it. One other thing I would note on this, there for a while people said, well, it must have been an accident, like some general got off the reservation and they weren't paying enough attention, and they regret. In fact, I even had some in the private sector. I'm in the private sector intelligence business. There was some material coming out saying, oh, this was something that was done by a junior. That was their own disinformation done by a junior person. I honestly believe that these things are cleared at the very top, that this is a highly controlled part of a strategy. And if it was some general, he would have been shot and it wouldn't stop. It hasn't stopped. Mm-hmm. So I think when we think about it, it's a thoughtful plan. It's not consistent with how we view the world. And I actually think that Putin is a great tactician and a lousy strategist, which we could talk about. But, this is not an accident. This is not, some one-off adventure that you're doing. It's part of your overall strategy. And it's much more aggressive than the Chinese. The Chinese are building military might, and that's, something we need to deal with. I don't anticipate a nose-to-nose with the Chinese. But right now, where is the troublemaker in the political arena? It's the Russians.
Mm-hmm. And with the Russians, they've taken this aggressive stance and they've taken it the next step. What do you foresee as being, what President Biden, who's now just been in office about a little more than a month, what's his what do you think his game plan has to be to right the ship, so to speak?
Right. So let me, with your indulgence, make two quick points. Another title of the book was going to be Dueling Banjos because the Russians would do something and then we'd play back. Then they would do something. This is true in Afghanistan, by the way, and when we get to it. it was dueling banjos until the singer came, and then all the strings broke on their banjo. But so there's this back and forth. So today the question is there going to be dueling banjos will be the big question. But I wanted to take just a second and talk about Putin, because this is a case of it takes two to tango. Mm-hmm. Biden, Trump may want to do whatever they want to do, but it takes another person to agree to play along, right? So I think we need to know what we need to understand the other player. And so the other player is being Putin, and I call it the spy master president. And the book, there's a chapter on it. And just like Never Trust the Russians in the subtitle under the spy master president is, there is no such thing as a former KGB officer, quote, Vladimir Putin.
So that yes. was
Putin. And I understand it as a former CIA guy. It doesn't mean, you know, I did turn in my card. I didn't, you know, people think I run ex-CIA agents. That's not true. You know, I went out and built my own foreign capability. But I'll tell you, I have a CIA mentality. You know, it's like, how do I look at the world? That's why I call it Spy Master's Prison. I look at it from sort of the environment I grew in, just like you would look at it from a special forces. How do you look at things, right? So I would say to you, Putin is self-declaring. The way I look at the world is a KGB guy. And what kind of KGB guy was he? Well, he wanted to join at 17. They didn't accept him, but he got in eventually. And he was a true believer in being a KGB person, appealed to his personality. But he wasn't sent to Paris, Mexico City, Tokyo, where you have fine wines and you enjoy the benefits of the West. He was sent to Dresden, East Germany, you know, it's a dreadful place, you know. They hadn't had fine wines in decades. So, but in that time frame, the head of the East German service was a guy called Marcus Wolf. And Marcus Wolf was the ultimate spy master in the Cold War. He must have had, I think I heard once, 100,000 spies. He had the Sparrows and Cassina and Romeos. In other words, he was actually training officers to be attractive. The Romeos would try and recruit secretaries in the West, and the Sparrows, and he even opened the Bordello to try and recruit Western diplomats. So it was a hard-nosed Cold War place, right? And so when the Soviet Union fell, Putin is there, and by his own words, and I understand it, I can identify as a CIA, must have been totally devastated what happened to him, his service, his mission, you know, his country. And he, you know, set out that was never going to happen again. Russia would be strong again. And he went off to St. Petersburg and got into politics, and then got tied in with Yeltsin and the powerhouses in Russia. Thought, well, he's one of the company guys. He's manageable. And that was probably true until the day he became, you know, the president. But before that, he did serve as the head of the FSB, their version of the FBI. So even after he left the KGB, he was running internal operations, the internal operation in Russia, or even underhanded. So you have someone who has a Cold War mindset, just like you, just like many of you. You know, he has a way of looking at the world. So he looks at it like Comrade J, number one target, U.S., you know, they humiliated us, and now, you know, we're going to be strong again. So what did he do? He set out to get back the Ukraine and Crimea. The Soviet Union was a much more economically important base with Ukraine than without it. Today, the GDP of Russia is probably matching Spain or Italy. So he took very aggressive actions. These are Cold War actions, or getting into Syria. So he has a lousy strategy, because I think Russia belongs in the West. I mean, there's no communism. They should benefit from the economic well-being of the West and the liberal roots. But he has decided, no, we are still the adversary. And he's going to do those things to make his country strong and in an adversarial position. We need to understand this before we go and say, hey, look, let's go to Moscow and charm the guy. Or, you know, Right. When he showed up in Helsinki, for example, and he showed up with his talking points. He knew what he was going to be doing in that. And I think our side was thinking, look, you know, charm, we'll put a charm offensive on him. And so this comes back to your question about the Biden administration. Now, a lot of the folks that are in there have worked with the Russians before. They have views about it. The question I have is, it's certainly not going to be won over by charming, right? It's, we're going to have to show some strength and resolve in this. And the last time when the Russians went into the Crimea and eastern Ukraine using covert action assets, you know, green men, as they said, green people, our response was pretty limp. And also they used tremendous amount of cyber. In fact, they had just over the last couple of days, another major cyber assault in Ukraine. You know, very, very aggressive in executing it. So when they get to the table, you know, they're going to try and create a new treaty on arms, and the Russians weren't honoring it the last time. So, I mean, I think, you know, part of our national strength is we need to get our act together at home. We have to be, we have to return to bipartisan issues on national security. We need to get the economy marching, make sure our military is well taken care of and modern in the way that it needs to be. I wouldn't worry about our military facing the Russians, and God forbid they ever get to that, because I do think we have the best military in the world. So there's, I think just jawboning this thing, you're not going to change him on his strategy. And there has to be some sub rosa, you know, confidential discussions about what are the limits of this cyber, where, because we're not going to go to war on the ground. You know, how far, what are the rules of the game? And, you know, this has to cease and desist. And if it doesn't, then I think there's a hard decision that the Biden administration has to make, and that is, Do you start the band up with the dueling banjos? Because you cannot let it go unresolved, and you have to make it sufficiently, you try and calibrate it so it's commensurate to the action, your response is commensurate with it, not excessive and not weaker than. So I think there's some tough decisions ahead, mm-hmm. but I think there are people underestimate Putin and the fact that he knows what he's doing. He knows he has a strategy. We don't like it. And the only way you back somebody off is you have to be strong. Our military has to be strong. Our country has to be strong. We have to mean what we say. We can't, you know, puff out our chest and then fire a tomahawk into the desert, you know, and say, okay, now pay attention. So I think there's some tough years ahead with Russia and very tough years on China. So we need to be united. Our intelligence service have to be funded, and our military needs to be funded and prepared and as a deterrent to further aggression. So that's why I say in the subtitle of the book, you know, the fight against Russian aggression. So we have to recognize that's what it is, and then we have to, you know, do what needs to be done using all the toolboxes, and you save military response to the very end. And when you're looking at Russia and its nuclear power, we're not going to go toe to toe, but there'll probably be green men in places where we will have our version of green men as well.
Absolutely. And you know, speaking of Putin, and you know, who we know, the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, but it seems like we're, you know, every day it's seeming like Russia is more and more on that, you know, on that kind of footing. Who do you think, man, because I've heard rumors that his health isn't the greatest right now. If anything were to happen to him, do you have, in just a personal opinion, who might step in? Because it doesn't seem like he has any second in command around him.
Well, first, let me take the first point. I can't tell you over all my years how many state leaders were about to die. You can't tell me the 100 reports on Castro dying over years, right? We actually ran operations. It's in the public domain, but you know, one of the heads of state, we go to the bathroom someplace, we'd have some technicians test the urine if they'd have a pipe run off and test it, to see whether they were going to die, you know, and it always came back, hey, he's not as sick as you think he is. So I put no stock in that at all. I see, this is that wishful thinking. But the second part, you shouldn't wish for it because you don't know what's behind it. And when you have an autocratic government, they usually end badly. And there's a period of chaos, and it usually goes to the strong. And the problem today, it's a little bit harder to calibrate because the strong, the weapon they may have may be a 6x3 iPhone, right? And they're able to rally people out of the street. And so you could, really want the West, just like they should want a stable personality on our side. We want stability in Russia. Whatever it is, we would love to have transition. It's very interesting. I noticed in the book that President Bush forewarned Gorbachev, said, there's a coup coming. He said, I can handle it. Well, good luck. That didn't work out so well. So why did we do that? Not because we love Gorbachev, but we didn't want, we had no idea what was coming. They got nuclear weapons. So, I think the question of how he leaves. But I think what is more important today is the cracks that we're seeing from dissent because of the arrest of Navalny. Who wants to demonstrate? But who wants to demonstrate in the winter in Russia? You got to really be upset, So my point is, I think we're seeing some cracks here, and the problem in this modern age, if they have the same thing in the spring, you might get twice as many people out. It's, he needs to go to the mountain. Look, he's been a very successful, master. You got to tip your hat. He was in his 30s, I think, when he started his rise. He's the head of, and made, he consolidated power. Very impressive capabilities. Still relatively young in terms of national leaders today. Not mentioning our leaders, any of them by name, but. So I think he has to ask himself, is this hybrid strategy and being aggressive with the U.S., is that the right answer? Is that the future here? Is that going to, was Tip O'Neill, the famous congressman in Massachusetts who controlled the Congress in a masterful way, once said all politics are local, right? So the determining factor in Russia is what is happening inside Russia, right? And we should not mess around. I want to be clear. I'm not suggesting we mess around because you have no idea where it's going to end up. However, as I said, if he doesn't stop, then we've got to revisit the issue. But I would hope that he would look at his own situation and say, listen, I can have my cake and eat it too. I can still be the top guy, but I can have a role in the West and ameliorate things at home. Not easy to manage. But if he stays with a heart, it's a very tricky thing. He keeps... Navalny in prison, he has to be careful he doesn't make him a martyr, right? So, but if he's too weak, so he's probably trying to figure it out. But this is a challenge to him. And I would personally prefer, at some point, he's got to move on, that, that is done in through, you let free elections take place. And I don't think there's any experts. I was listening. I won't tell you the group where, they'll be calling me and yelling, people that study Russia and they, their view, they have no idea of, what comes next, who does. And that's why preparedness, the military and everybody on this call understands preparing the battlefield, right? Mm-hmm. So, we need to be prepared. We need to be prepared for all contingencies in the world. And we need to be alert. And there's stability inherent in autocratic governments. There's stability inherent in Russia. There's stability inherent in Iran. There's stability inherent in China, just to pick the big three. And they can come unraveled in ways that are surprising historically. I don't think any of them are on the ropes by any stretch of the imagination, but they all have internal problems that under the wrong set of circumstances, things can get out of hand. And I would say the one thing that's different today about, the covert action world and stability is things can unravel quickly because of social media and the cyber capabilities and communications capability. It doesn't help you rebuild a thing. That's one thing I can say. The social media can destroy a lot of things. It doesn't do building. So I think good intelligence, we have to really understand the dynamics of what's going on in these countries and not the wishful thinking of the business sector or the wishful thinking of someone who wants to do good. I mean, I think you have to take a hard-nosed look at the world and be prepared for multiple contingencies. And everybody understands that you know, the military has a plan. So, and that's necessary at times. It doesn't feel like it's productive, but until the crisis comes, and you can zero in on your plan that's closest to the reality.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
We're talking with Jack Devine, former acting director of operations for the CIA, who has written his book, which is titled Spy Masters Prism, The Fight Against Russian Aggression. It comes out on March 1st. And you touched on this briefly in the book, but I have to ask you, when it comes to Charlie Wilson, and we mentioned him earlier when we were talking, did you actually meet Charlie Wilson a lot, or was it just a few times? And what was your impression of the book and the film when it came out?
No, I got to know Charlie very well. Traveled with him. We went out to Pakistan a couple times, up in the Peshawar with the at the along the border. Some say that Charlie actually took a horse into Afghanistan. Others would say we staged it so he felt he was in Afghanistan. Well, not that. So he was underestimated by many people. He had a a notorious lifestyle, which he propagated. He created the myth or of Charlie, which maybe came into reality. But he was an Annapolis graduate. He was a serious guy, a smart, down-to-earth guy. You know, didn't have a dime, and he was in Texas, a young man, and you know, he made a role for himself. And when he had left the Congress and I had left the agency, he came to New York, and we had dinner at Sparks Restaurant. If you know Sparks Restaurant, that's where the mafia Don Castellano was assassinated, right?
Yes.
So appealed, Charlie had a sense of romance, right? Like, you can't go at, you know, Smith and Walensky and have a steak. No, you got to go to Sparks. So we go to Sparks. And we're with our wives, and he leaned across the table and said, "Jack, I know you didn't like the book, but God, you're going to hate the movie." And what he was really talking about, it wasn't Charlie Wilson's War. He was a bigger in life figure. I'm glad I know him, and I think he was a contributor to the effort. He was a good face out in meeting with the foreign leaders, and was always pushing, and down in the hill he was able to steer money. But it wasn't his program. And the reason this annoys me is because I think people in America need to understand covert action. That's why I wrote the first book, Good Hunting, and that is how does covert action run? And one of the great myths, which people don't understand, the President of the United States signs the approval. In other words, he says you can use force on this, right? And these are the guidelines. And now you have to go brief Congress, right? And Congress has to get in and fund you, right? And then you have the job. You got to get allies. You got to get people who want to fight. And I have a whole set of principles around this. So it's a government program. And so while I traveled and saw Charlie often, I would tell you, substantively, on decision making in the party, I don't think we had five discussions. And I can only remember one or two of them. And one was, why did you, Jack, shift buying weapons from the majority of the weapons from Egypt to China? Okay. Now, remember, this is going back when China was allied with us here. And they said, very simple reason, Charlie, they're providing the quicker, faster, cheaper, right? They said, I got it. Okay. So the point was, Charlie had no say in it. Now, if you were to go in Charlie's office, he had a Stinger missile hanging over his door. And it came from a CIA, CIA office that thought, oh, that'd be nice, give Charlie a Stinger, right?
Yeah.
But what it did is it identified him with the Stinger missile. And that's not how the Stinger went in. Charlie actually opposed it. He thought he was doing a good thing because I think someone whispered in his ear, tell the Pakistanis when the officials come out that you don't need or want Stingers in the program. And that's what happened for a while, because there were people in Washington that were afraid that if the Stinger went in, it would be World War III. So when I arrived at the Afghan task force, I did have a good feeling for this sense of concern. And I was looking at it as, what changes this war? And we were 9 million pounds of ordnance was going across the border, and it was daily, and it was locked. Was it daily or monthly? I've forgotten. But the line, we couldn't cross the line because the Russians were using their Spetsnaz and their Hind helicopters, and was suppressing it. And we had, like, dueling banjos again. We would put in one weapon system. You know, we started out with, like, World War II weapons, rifles, and then by the end we had very sophisticated weapons. And the Stinger was an amplification because there was no U.S. weapons in the battlefield other than the Stinger. So it was a big policy decision. And I went down to the White House one day, and the agency had voted against it, and voted against it. They showed a mock shoot down of the Stinger. And I said, damn it, we need that. So everybody in the room didn't say, your office has been voting this down. They said, oh, Jack, great idea. Great idea. They wrote a memo, and it ends up, you know, the president signing off. The next time I get a call, they said, go over and talk to a three-star general. I know his name, but I won't mention him. A good guy, three-star general, head of logistics. I said, look, I need X number of your thing. He said, look, the boys don't have it. I said, look, I understand it, but we're out there now, and I've been told to come. And he said, oh, well, I'd like to give it to you, but, you know, go pound sand or whatever. So I called the White House and said, you go back tomorrow. So I went back tomorrow dutifully. And, you know, I just empathized with his position because he really didn't want to do it, and I understood his reasoning. And, you know, it's like you bite your lip and the blood starts to come out of the corners. Okay, you can have them, right? But don't come back. So I never saw them again. So they went in. And what I'm saying to you is how the weapons were organized, who got what, when they got it, where, what was the strategy. This wasn't Charlie's game. Charlie's was, he worked the Hill very well, and he was a good ambassador and, you know, a good morale guy. But if you come to me and say, listen, Jack, why don't you and I put a movie together? We're going to have all these bureaucrats, you and all the other bureaucrats, and we'll get some mule skinners in this, and we'll throw a little of this in. Let's make a movie. Say, oh, that's boring. No one's going to watch that. Oh, let's get a congressman with Julie Roberts, and they solve the whole world. They go out single-handedly with some crazy CIA guy, and all works out, and the whole thing falls. Well, it became a great book, a great movie, and, you know, but it just isn't a reality. So when you get around and say, listen, I have a problem, let's go find some congressman and some socialite and see if we can't go out there and change things. To change the world with covert action, and this was the most successful operation, I think, in the history of the agency up to that point, you know, requires a lot of people doing a lot of different things, multiple allies, logistics. It was a war of logistics. That's not run by a single congressman. That's, you know, offices and people. And I think, Steve, you even had a hand in the mule, my favorite mule.
That's mule it. I mean, story. You know, when you mentioned mule skinners, at the time, I mean, there was no, as we all know, logistics drive the train. And, you know, we talked about that earlier. And you know, the Mujahideen at that time, they didn't have logistics. So, you know, the agency was going to furnish them with mules from China, which is like, you know, unbelievably. And so the agency got special forces on board, and they said, you know, we need you guys to come up with some mule packs for the mules, the panniers. And this is the kind of stuff that they're going to be carrying. We need, you know, Russian 82-millimeter mortars. We need Stinger missiles. We need ammo crates and all this. And my team, you know, we were involved with that. I don't think I'm breaking any security regulations this many years after the fact. But it was very interesting because, you know, when we first started it, we were working on it down in the mountains in Honduras with Honduran soldiers. And the first day that, you know, we were going to leave the compound, we had everything all strapped up and we thought we had it down. And by the end of the day, everything was falling out. The mules were falling down. The packs were falling off. I think we got about 500 yards. You could still see the gate of the compound. And then, you know, each day we'd have to go back and, you know, change things a little bit. And we ended up working it all out. And later, after the fact, as you and I were talking, when all this came out later on, and, you know, with the agency's efforts with the Mujahideen, we saw the mules, pictures of them with the Mujahideen guys, and we saw those saddles, and we were like, hey, we made those.
So, but, you know, Steve, it was such an important, I mean, you know, we're talking down in the weeds, but that's how logistics is, down in the weeds. So if you looked at the program, and again, I keep the juxtaposition of Charlie beside you, this isn't Charlie's game. So first of all, you have to buy $1 billion worth of weapons. Where do you buy them? You can't buy, you can't get American weapons. You have to buy them. That's a logistical problem. How do you get them out there? That means boats, trains. I mean, at one point, I probably owed more Toyota trucks than anybody in Asia because we had trucks. But you got to a certain point, and the trucks couldn't go over the mountains, right? And you needed the mules, or you're going to stay at the bottom. So unbeknownst to you, maybe at the time, but we were buying 9,000 mules and marching them across China because Pakistani mules did not work. And the other thing is, I'm a city guy. I don't know, you know, as I said before, a horse or a mule, but I'll tell you, Tennessee mules do not work in Afghanistan, right? So it's, you had to know this stuff and you needed experts. And so we ended up Chinese mules worked. And then you needed saddles. You needed tailored saddles to carry the type of weapons. And it was a big breakthrough. So the point that I would make is, there were lots of people, and you touched it, and there was, you know, a guy that, you know, mule skinners and all these experts that were in there, medical trainers, you know, the stingers weren't, you know, they were trained, they weren't trained by an agency guy. You had a couple of people that came out of Fort Bragg, that had just been trained on it, went out there, and everybody did their part. So when the Russians left and they marched across the Friendship Bridge, a cable went out from the agency saying, "We won." And I thought that was the right pronoun, we. Lots of people over many years contributed. So this is why Charlie said, "Jack, you're gonna hate the movie."
Well, it's not
because of Charlie. It's not about Charlie. It's about how are things done and running these types of efforts. And again, I'm not a logistics guy. I know a hell of a lot more about it now. I knew enough to get some really good logistic guys around me that were outstanding. And I just read a book on General Grant, and he had a spotty career, will be nice. But when you got into the Civil War, and I started to look at it instead of the glory of, and I don't want to offend anyone who's a fan of Robert E. Lee, but Grant was a quartermaster out in some Western fort or something during the Indian Wars. And he was a logistics guy. At the end, that war was all, the Civil War, one of the great tragedies of our country. The confrontation, it was logistics. So I am now a believer in logistics. If you're going to go into any sort of combat of any proportions, or you're going to go into a covert action operation, or you're going to run a political operation, you need to get your blocking and tackling done. You need to get your plumbing done. You need your master sergeant. In other words, you can't think in these broad movie tones of how things go. And it's hard work. You know, if you're looking for glory, don't look for the logistics job, you know. And I went out of my way at the end when I was leaving to make special note to the logistics. They're unsung heroes. And so a lot of people get the glory, but the real backbone are logistics. So if you got folks out there that log time, if you will, in logs, then, you know, I tip my hat to them. It wasn't Charlie Wilson's, where I would say at the end of the day, it probably was the logs team that made this happen. And frankly, let me just make a comment about Congress and the President of the United States. Both of them were 100%. Republicans and Democrats, they couldn't do enough down on the Hill. Now, you were in Honduras, my counterparts who went down talking about Central America, they didn't have it, and it ended up the way it did. But on this particular project, when it works, you know, you have to have Congress. You have to have it. You have to have the budget, and you can't be leaking and all the things, terrible things that happened today. And the President of the United States has to put his signature down on the line. And then people and professionals can do what they can do, and the professionals and military and the agency can get it done. So they're the basic ingredients. So it's not about Charlie at all. And I have nothing but good things to say about Charlie. But I want people to understand how wars are and covert wars are run.
Yeah, and it's just Hollywood. They have put a face on it, so they can sell it, and you know what better.
You wouldn't sell it. You wouldn't, Steve. You wouldn't sell it with my face. Let me tell you. If you look at
nor mine. So
Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks. I'm not. Bela Lugosi, maybe.
Yeah. But I wanted to ask you. I know that you served in the agency for 30 years, and a lot of the, I've done a lot of research on the early days of the agency, because so many of them came from OSS and which was the forerunner of both the agency and the Army Special Forces. Bill Colby, Bill Casey, Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, and my favorite person from OSS who will later join CIA was Virginia Hall. Did you get to meet any of these, you know, the people that started the agency back in the day?
I did. In fact, most of the people when I first joined had roots in it. I mean, it was, you know, these are the big names. These were the public figures, right? But, you know, the chief of China, the chief of Latin America, they had all logged time in World War II and in OSS in particular. And Bill Casey, I mean, you know, the director. It was OSS Europe. But Virginia Hall, I didn't know from Adam, except when I was in the, I guess I was on the Dominican Republic desk, which was not the center of the world, although in 65 it was, and I joined afterwards. But I was standing in the hallway, and the guy beside me sort of straightened up, right? And a woman walked by, nothing nowhere. They said, "Well, you seem to really come alive," and she walked by. I said, "Well, that's Virginia Hall, you know." As well, who's Virginia Hall? And now today she's better known, but back then. So Virginia Hall, for the listeners, actually, if you go into CIA, this is very, might be of a human interest story. You go in, and it's beautifully done, in my view. It's one of the best architectural buildings in government. So I obviously have a bias, but I'll leave out all the dynamics. I do go into the book at the beginning because there's some meaning to the entranceway and the stars and the quotes. But on the wall, as you're going down the right-hand side, there are paintings that have been professionally done and commissioned. Someone commissions them and it's painted. And the first one, they moved them around a little bit, was Virginia Hall. Further down, number three or four along the wall, is the second, when a replica of the Stinger shootdown, taken by video at the time and then transposed into a formal painting. So Virginia Hall, the picture has her in it, looks like a tent cranking out messages. But Virginia Hall was spoke French fluently, and she was in Turkey as a young woman and had a hunting accident and badly damaged, lost the bottom part of her leg, and she had artificial limb in those days. And she tried to, you know, gutsy gal, tries to join during World War II, and the Brits took her in. And then she got into the OSS, and she dropped, they dropped her behind the lines in France, and she became the most wanted spy by the Nazis because she was one of the principal organizers of the resistance and the communicator in France. And and she was received the top medal from the French, the British, and the Americans for her deeds. People that she worked with, many of them were executed. She got out just in time. She went out over the mountains with the leg. She had a nickname for it. It was Crothers or something.
Cuthbert.
Yeah, that was it. That was it. So they sent a message saying, "Are you having trouble getting out?" They said, "Oh, the only problem is with, what was the name again?"
Cuthbert. She named her leg.
So I said, "Well, no problems with this." And so they sent a note, "Terminate." "No, shoot them." When things, that was OSS, CIA didn't do that. But
yeah.
So a lot of people, but I was recruited in the Latin America division. His alias was Tom Bender. That's not his real name. But he also worked behind the lines in France, organizing resistance. So it wasn't just these top level people. I would say the entire building was permeated with OSS. And it's not just people, but people bring cultures with them. And it was the thing that I associated most with the agency through my career was a spirit of can do. You want an elephant delivered tomorrow to Boston or Shanghai, I got it. Can do. And there was an esprit and a sensitivity about people and, you know, caring for people. It was something to behold. The other thing that I found fascinating is if you're a self-promoter in that group, I'm not saying there wasn't any, but, you know, it was all about mission. And if you looked like you were just hustling, you didn't, your career didn't go anywhere. They really believe in God and country, and they behave that way. The other thing that, you know, people think, you know, CIA lie, cheat, and steal, but it has a very high standard inside to protect itself, I guess. But, you know, we produce a lot of intelligence and a lot of delicate operation. And I think of my career, and if three people looked me in the eye and lied to me, a lot of people didn't tell me the whole story, which is a little different. It's a lot. If you ever get caught lying about anything you're doing, the reporting, you're finished. It's just so fundamental. As I said, you walk through the door, you shall know the truth, and it'll set you free. If you do not adhere to that, you're finished. And that was a culture that was instilled in the agency from the OSS, and a lot of dedicated people, great sacrifice, and no glory. You know, today I'm allowed to write a book because I'm tired of other people writing books telling their story and have never been there. But, you know, they were all quiet, and the intelligence side is very quiet. The reason I'm able to write, I became part public at the end, but more importantly, I got involved in, one can ask himself why, but I think partly because I ran to it, is covert action. So I was involved in a lot of covert action, and that almost always becomes public. So the things we've talked about today are all in the public record because these are been declassified and so on. What isn't declassified is how to think about it. And I think that's a contribution. I think I make two contributions when I write. One is pulling the facts together in one place to make a coherent whole out of it. And second, I use my spy master's prism to give my interpretation for what it, you know, for what it's worth. It's my look at the business, these events from that optic. And the prism allows that a lot of other people can be looking at it differently. And I'm fully understanding of that, but I want to make sure that the intelligence prism, at least from one optic mind, has a hearing.
Well, it wouldn't be our complete podcast if we didn't get into some of the more difficult parts of the history of the agency, and that was. There was a couple of moles, Russian moles, and involved with one of them, Aldrich Ames, and the other, Robert Hansen. But Robert Hansen was an FBI agent. But I think both of them caused untold amount of damage. And you talked about that in the book. And, you know, one of the things that came out about both of them, and you mentioned this, is they were both kind of underachievers. And that's kind of, you know, is this the kind of thing that our counterintelligence people look for, is guys who are underachieving, guys who are kind of stymied in their career?
Yes, that's the short answer. Long answer is it's the counterintelligence business. Finding spies within the system is a real art form. And again, it's another one, it's like logistics. It's unsung. You know, you usually don't get an award for finding a spy. At least in our culture, the KGB gives you a medal if you find an American spy in your system. We tend to give out reprimands. But so I knew Rick Ames, and I knew him reasonably well. And that's why it's more painful when you know you meet a spy and you know them and you've worked with them. You know, it leaves a lot of introspection. But I knew Rick from the reverse day I walked into the building. He was working on Russia. I was working on Eastern Europe in an administrative job, just basically looking at cables and assigning them to be filed somewhere. But, you know, he was someone that came from a CIA family. I really didn't have any roots background. I can blue collar background. Foreign Service, what is that? Is that the Foreign Legion? So, you know, it was he was steeped in the lore of it, I went to his wedding. He liked to smoke, he liked to have a drink, but he was not very materialistic, kind of unkempt, if you will. And I didn't see him for 20 years. But over those 20 years, what Surfers with Rick was, and then retrospect as well, you know, you think you can size up the ego of somebody, but what I learned over many years is that whatever you think an ego is, it's probably twice the size. Even people that look humble have an ego. So in Rick's case, you know, because I didn't see the reason why would you have such a big ego, right? He's a smart guy, read a lot. His performance, he just was a terrible underperformance. He did very well on things he liked, you know, but he can't go to life saying, listen, I just like to do one thing, right? You know, cleaning the gun. I'm not going to clean the gun. I'll just shoot it, you know. Well, that's good. So he was an underperformer. And what happens, and this is why I think it is a telltale sign when you look for, when you go hunting for a spy. And that's when you have this narcissistic, bigger than life ego, and it can be subdued. You don't have to be walking around in a flashy suit. I mean, it's just, you just have to be able to understand that people really think they're good. And combined with underperforming, and then they cannot figure out, I'm so good, why am I not being promoted when Jack DeMont's being promoted, right? And so it's that gap between self-evaluation and performance. And then they become dissatisfied with the system. Rick was not converted to communism. Robert Hansen never converted to communism. They just thought that they were really gifted men and nobody appreciated them, and they were getting the wrong end of the stick. So, you know, where does treason begin? It begins in the mind, and it begins in this space. Both of them had the fluke of life. The Russians got so lucky that in one point in time, they had two of the guys in the most sensitive Russia offices, you know, in the U.S. government, right? So that's luck, but you can't argue against it. So they not only had the treasonous mind, they had access to things that mattered. And in Rick's case, he drank and drank a lot. The medic said he was an alcoholic, but it's the distinction without a difference, in other words. And so he drank a lot, but it was episodical. So he had a reason to go in the Russian embassy because he had a reason, because he's a Russian CIA, Russian specialist. He had a reason. And he sat outside in Georgetown and had three or four or five vodkas or whatever, and then decided he was going to walk in. And he was going to handle, this is the other part of the, he could handle them, right? So then he was going to give a little sheet of paper with a couple of names on or something. And the second meeting, he dumped 11 of our best Russians in the Kremlin and intelligence services. He gave them the whole, it was in June or July of 85, and he gave them the crown jewels. They all were executed. Mm. The KGB was urging not to execute them, right? Because what they wanted to do was to run operations. But the Politburo just found it such an affront to the communist system or whatever. They had them all executed. But it took a while for the agency to come to terms with it. Same with the FBI. I was hunting for Hansen in CIA because I knew there was another Mulder. James didn't answer all the questions, but the FBI thought he was in CIA, but later on it turned out he was smack in the middle of their Russian operation. So the opportunities that they had made a big difference in when they absolutely started working for the Russians. And what was interesting in both cases, I should point about the other side of the flip coin, and there's movies out. So if you look at the movies, you have to pay careful attention. Breach, which I think is a very good movie about Hansen. But you have to listen carefully because it looks like all the work is being done by getting his, what they used to call a pilot, and getting his phone. But the title of my chapter is It Takes a Spy to Catch a Spy. Right? Mm-hmm. And so the way we got Hansen, the way we got Ames is, another spy, a Russian spy, gave them up, right? And we had a hard time, as I was saying a few minutes ago, coming to terms that we actually had a spy. The FBI had it. Can't be one of us. We're all patriots, right? And what I make the point in my book for those that are going to become students of intelligence business, you must assume you always have spies. We've always had them inside our system. We have them inside our government. It's naive to think otherwise, and you need to have a strong counterintelligence. But it took us a few years to find Ames because we got distracted when Lone Tree walked in, left the Russians in the embassy in Moscow. We thought that's how we lost our agents. And then there was a technological reason. They spent a year analyzing beams bouncing off of us. And eventually they went, they almost didn't go back. One woman, Jean Vertebrae, was about to retire. She said, let me go through the file again. Let me see if I can find something. And then hence began the unraveling of Ames, and then we got a break with the defector. So it's an important, I spend more time on spy cases and good hunting. I spend a lot on covert action. Both of them have spy cases and so on. But, you know, they're fascinating to read, and you can, the reason I say it takes a spy to catch a spy is when I went back and started doing the research, it's very hard for me to find one that wasn't compromised by another spy. And I think it's an interesting read in that regard.
Yeah. And again, I mean, well, I asked you for 60 minutes of your time. We're almost at an hour and a half, but I did want to ask you, you know, from an insider's perspective, somebody who spent a good chunk of your life there, how do you feel the agency's looking moving forward? I know we kind of switch gears a little bit after 9/11, and you know, we got the entire apparatus involved with counterterrorism, and now it looks like we're going back to the big game with the Russians and the Chinese. How are we looking? How do you feel like the CIA is matching up, switching gears at this point?
So your last point is, is a really good one about the change in targeting, right? So I must say, every once in a while I get things right. In the good hunting, I basically said that, you know, this is in 14, that basically we were going to be moving into a new target set, which would be nationalism was coming back and we'd be going back to the hard targets and terrorism will be waning. But I very carefully put in that terrorism was not going away totally. You know, any given day, I mean, you know, 9/11, that one day changed the next 20 years in terms of how we were going to spend money in national defense. So, but it seemed to me that it was a trend line in terrorism. We've seen it spike in the 70s. It was much worse than the 9/11 attack, and you know, a lot of effort was put into fighting it. But we shifted, because the Cold War had come to an end, we shifted to the counterterrorism arena, and all agencies, you know, budgets were funneled into it. And it changes, it becomes a different target set. Different types of people need to do the jobs. Heavy emphasis on paramilitary, tactical. And I think, you know, we could see it changing over the last couple of years. And the agency and all the military has to go through the same process of how do you readjust now to a to a nation state like China. How do you deal with an aggressive Russia, and how do you allocate your budget? So if you're internally in both the military and the CIA, you have to do some soul searching. We've done it before, but military and the CIA, and you have to ask, what type of soldiers are we going to need? What are targets? What tools are we going to use? So I think my exposure to the CIA would suggest that we have, you know, very talented people. We certainly have talented people in the military. The military is one of the best trainers in history in how to train vast numbers of people with diverse backgrounds. So I think we have that capability. I think there's a question of will outside of the agency and outside of the military. And that is, where is this country? Where do we want to go? What's the policy? In other words, if you tell the military, this is what I want done, they'll get it done. You tell the agency, these are the priorities. So I, again, from back to dysfunctional Congress, you know, we need to get our act together on What is it that we're going to be doing with these tools? And I think the presidential policy, they have to decide, you know, what matters. I think the agencies are capable of doing it, but they all have to they're in a process, they need to go through a process of retooling and how they do it. And the other thing that I would say, and I would say less, this is less true of the military, because their weapons are modernized and the support things are modernized and it's an overt world. In other words, that's not exactly true. The fact that you're modernizing, eventually the fact that you have an advanced weapon system is visible to everybody. The production of it is very secret. But in the intelligence world, we're moving so fast in terms of cyber and communications and what's possible. Can the people inside the agency, are they tooled? Are we collecting the right way? Are we the way that we collected in my era? Is it the same approach? Are we modern enough? And I think the book is to be written yet on that. Past my experience would tell me in the past we measured up and made the adjustments every time there was an innovation. But I do think we're in a transition here, partly a policy transition, partly the tools of spying, the tools of warfare training. We need to make sure we've got the right tools lined up for the right targets. And we need to change our mindset about how we do certain things. Are we going to wait for somebody to walk into an embassy when we have a 20-foot wall around it? How are we getting sources when you can use your phone to reach thousands of people and basically cold pitch them if that's what you want to do? But those decisions have to be made. I don't think they're completely joined yet. I think it's in process, and I guess I would say I'm optimistic, but recognizing that there's no smooth path forward. There'll be bumps. There'll be failures. But hopefully the failures turn into, successes because you learn from them. So I think there's I think we're going into a bumpy road on so many aspects of American life, including national security. I want to be clear. It's not tied to Trump. It's not tied to Biden. It's where are we as in our national psyche? Where mm-hmm. are we and what matters to us?
Well, we encourage all our listeners to read Jack Devine's new book, A Spy Master's Prism, The Fight Against Russian Aggression. It comes out on March 1st. It is definitely a compelling read, and we want to thank you, sir, for your service, your 32 years with the Central Intelligence Agency, and now he's a founding partner and the president of the Arkin Group, which is Internal Crisis Management and Strategic Intelligence organization, but it's not a mini CIA as he put out earlier. But before we go, I just need to read something real quick. If you want to get SoftRep on your phone, download our free mobile app and get easy access to our articles, podcasts, gear reviews, all perfectly formatted to your device. Please subscribe to SoftRep.com to get access to our library of ebooks and our exclusive team room forums and content, all available on Apple and Android devices. Jack, thank you for taking the time with us today. I wish we could spend another 3 hours. I could talk to you about a myriad of other subjects, and I would love to pick your brain on it, but we'll have to do this again sometime real soon. But thank you, and thanks for your service. Thanks for your input today. I think all of our listeners will really get a lot out of this.
And thank you for giving me an opportunity to say thank you to all the folks out there, because
good luck with the book. Now, do you have any book signings coming? I know with COVID, it's probably not as prevalent as those things used to be.
Right. I think what I'm going to try and do, and maybe I can follow up behind this with, you know, if you could put out sort of links where they can get the books, it would be helpful.
Sure.
In the old days, I would show up and sign a lot of books, but I don't think that's going to happen, and it's a limiting factor. But I do think I'm going to have systematized linking so listeners can more easily. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, It's out there and readily available. But and if someone likes it, write a good review. If they don't like it, don't do anything.
Well, we'll be writing a review from my reading of it. It'll be out right about the time the podcast comes out, and it should be right around the time the book gets released. So hopefully we can help you generate a couple of sales of that as well.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure. I mean, it's really good to have an interview with someone that's actually read the material and knowledgeable about it, and some of the fun things with the mules was great. Just when you send it out, just flag it for me, the link, because I'm going to put it out to our clients and friends too, and make sure they know about the radio program. So thank you very much.
Sure thing. And thanks again for joining us. And thanks for all our listeners out there. For myself, Steve Balsuri, our special guest today, Jack Devine from CIA. And definitely read his book, Spy Master's Prism. For all of us here, we'll be back real soon with another podcast.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.